Welcome to the Deadcast.
Joining me this week as we look at the case of John Wayne Gacy. I've kind of been building up to this case throughout this season with my talks about Dean Corll, the Houston mass murderer, and Sidney Cook, Charles Ray Hatcher, among others. Before we get into that case, however, as always, I have my normal plugs. If you would like to help support the show, you can find me on pretty much all social media. On Facebook, I'm under Ian Totten, author. There's a Deathcast link on that page, which will take you to a group specifically dedicated to this show. You can find me on Twitter at Author Totten. You can find me on Instagram at Ian Totten Author. You're on MeWe, you can find me under Ian Totten. You can also find my books on Amazon. Just search for Ian Totten. I have 5 books out under my own name, as well as on Audible. I have 1 book up there right now, The House of Silver Doors, with another, The Throwaway Girls of Olympia, supposed to be coming out here in the next few months. If you'd like to help support the show further, you can find me on Patreon at Ian Totten Author. There's about 2 or 3 different tiers up there right now. I believe the second level tier I have set to host special Patreon exclusive episodes of the Deathcast. You can also, if you'd like to make a one-time donation, I am on Vimeo and PayPal under Ian Totten. And that money is used towards the production of this show, such as should my computer go out or any equipment breaking. The book of the week this week is Banyan Investigations, Inc., a Craig Banyan anthology by my good friend James Mullaney. If you're not familiar with James Mullaney, I've talked about his work before on the show. He has worked for Marvel Comics. He was a ghostwriter on the Destroyer Men's Action Adventure series. He's currently helping to develop the Craig Banyan books into an animated show for Fox Television. He's been around, and he might possibly be the best, least heard of author out there today. The Banyan books are hilarious, mystery, fantasy books about an alcoholic, smart-ass private investigator named Craig Banyan. I'm currently about three-quarters of the way through the book right now, and I really can't recommend it enough. If you've never read any of the other 9 books in the series, it's a really good place to start. Again, as I said, the book is called Banyan Investigations, Inc., a Craig Banyan anthology by James Mullaney. That's Mullaney. It's available in paperback and on Kindle through Amazon, so go out and grab that one today. You won't regret it. All right, now that all the plugs are out of the way, get yourself something to drink, sit back in a chair, relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. So, as you heard in the trailer for the show, we are going to be discussing serial killer John Wayne Gacy this week. He's one of the most infamous serial killers in American history and possibly in world history. There's very few people you can mention the term killer clown to who would not instantly know who it was you were talking about in terms of serial killers. In fact, he's one of the inspirations for Stephen King's character Pennywise the Dancing Clown. Gacy's one of the few killers who has kind of permeated pop culture in America. But who was John Wayne Gacy? John Wayne Gacy was born in Chicago, Illinois on March 17, 1942. He was the second child and only son of John Stanley Gacy and Marion Elaine Robinson. And Gacy has said that his father was an extreme alcoholic. It's known that he was an auto mechanic as well as a World War I veteran, while his mother was a homemaker. And it's been said that Gacy had a very close relationship with his mother and his two sisters, but that his relationship with his father was very chaotic. As I had already mentioned, his father was an alcoholic who routinely, physically, emotionally, and verbally abused his family. And the older Gacy seemed to take a almost perverse delight in tormenting young John, often calling him dumb and stupid or referring to him by such terms as a fairy or a queer. And Gacy himself has said that his father talking to him in this manner had a severe impact on his mental well-being. So much so that Gacy was constantly seeking his father's approval throughout his life. And according to Gacy himself, while he loved his father, he felt that he was quote-unquote never good enough in the older man's eyes. Now, the first reported incident of any sexual in regards to Gacy came in 1949 when his father was informed that his son and another boy had been caught sexually molesting a younger girl. Reportedly, Gacy's father whipped him with a razor strap as punishment. And according to Gacy himself, that same year, a friend and contractor who was friends with his father began molesting him in his truck. And this was something that Gacy never told his father about, as he was afraid that his father would see it as proof that his son was in fact gay and blame him for it. He was an overweight child, and apparently he had a heart condition, as he was told in school that he should avoid all forms of sports. But his medical problems were not just limited to the heart condition. It's been reported that Gacy began to experience blackouts when he was in the fourth grade, and he was hospitalized once for one of these episodes, with Gacy going on to estimate that he had spent about a year between the ages of 14 and 18 in a hospital, which he attributed to the decline in grades that he experienced from missing school due to these hospitalizations. Again, the older Gacy played a major role in John's life at this point, as he saw these hospitalizations and the blackouts as an excuse from his son to gain sympathy from others, and he openly accused him of faking them. It should be noted, however, that his medical condition was never officially diagnosed. He is known to have attended four separate high schools, although he never graduated. In fact, Gacy dropped out of high school, and he began working in politics around 1960 when he was 18. He was an assistant precinct captain for a Democratic Party candidate in his neighborhood. Once again, his father ridiculed Gacy for this, calling him a patsy and a soft-hearted liberal. And Gacy has gone on to speculate that the reason he got involved with politics was in an attempt to gain acceptance from others, because he never received any from his own father. One incident involving his father is that his father bought Gacy a car at some point in this time period, although he kept the title under his own name, and Gacy was required to make monthly payments on the car to his father. And his father would take the car keys anytime that John did not give in and do as he was told, as well as anytime that he disrespected his father. This reached kind of a boiling point when Gacy decided to get another pair of keys made for the car, and his father retaliated by removing the distributor cap from the car, which he kept for 3 days. Gacy later went on to say that he felt totally sick and drained after this. It was because of this that Gacy ended up leaving Chicago once his father had put the distributor cap back in the car. He drove to Las Vegas and found work, working at the Palm Mortuary. Now, a couple different sites list different titles which he was under. Some say that he was a mortuary assistant, while others state that he was a janitor. What is known for certain, however, is that Gacy slept on a cot behind the embalming room, and that he worked there for 3 months observing the morticians as they embalmed the dead bodies. He went on to claim later that one night when he was alone at the mortuary, he climbed inside one of the coffins, which contained the body of a recently deceased teenage boy, and began to caress and fondle the body. The experience lasted for a few moments before Gacy was overcome with a sense of shock and revulsion. And as a consequence of this, he proceeded to call his mother to find out what the waters were like back home as to whether his father would allow him to return or not. And eventually, the older Gacy relented, and John left that day to drive back to Chicago. Upon returning home, he eventually enrolled at Northwestern Business College. And it's been noted that during this period that he was in college, he developed a talent for salesmanship. Despite never graduating high school, Gacy ended up graduating from college in 1963. And very soon afterwards, he took a management position with the Nunn Bush Shoe Company. And he excelled in this position to the point that he was transferred to Springfield, Illinois after only about 3 months to work as a salesman, which quickly led to a full-on promotion to managing his own department. And he worked there for nearly a year, during which time he began dating a co-worker by the name of Marilyn Myers, and they eventually became engaged. And it was during this period of time that his political career really began to take off. Gacy joined the local chapter of the JCs, which stands for the United States Junior Chamber of Commerce. And basically what they would do is organize civic projects, helping to feed the homeless and all that kind of stuff, forming committees. Gacy threw himself into this volunteer work, so much so that he was named Key Man in April of 1964. And that same year, by his own recounting, Gacy had his second homosexual experience. According to him, one of his colleagues in the Springfield JCs plied him with drinks and invited him to spend the evening on the sofa, which Gacy agreed to. Later, the colleague performed oral sex on him while he was drunk. Despite this, or maybe because of it, by 1965, Gacy had risen to the position of vice president of the JCs, and he ended up getting married to Marilyn that year. And Marilyn came from a very affluent family. They were so affluent, in fact, that his father-in-law ended up purchasing 3 Kentucky Fried Chickens in Waterloo, Iowa. And the family ended up moving there so that Gacy could manage the restaurants, with the understanding that they would move into Gacy's in-law's former home. Now, this was something that Gacy could not turn down, as the position basically paid him $15,000 a year, plus a share of the restaurant's profits. Now, he was required to go through a management course as part of being in the Kentucky Fried Chicken organization. And by all accounts, Gacy was very good at his job. One thing, however, that Gacy did during this time was open what he called a club in his basement, where he would allow his employees to come and drink alcohol and play pool. One of the things that can be noted from this is that the majority of the people employed at the KFC were young teenage males. And during these parties in the basement, Gacy would sexually proposition a number of the different young men, and if they happened to, spur his advances, he would claim that he was only joking around, or that it was a test of their moral character to see if they were really into that kind of thing or not. At this period of his life has been described as perfect by Gacy. His wife gave birth to a son in February of 1966 and a daughter in 1967. The reason that he considered this period in his life perfect was his father had finally told Gacy that he had gained his approval. Place in July of 1967 when his parents visited the family and his father pulled him aside and apologized for the years of physical and emotional abuse that he had perpetrated against him, saying, "Son, I was wrong about you," as he shook Gacy's hand. While he was in Iowa, Gacy once again became involved with the local chapter of the JCs, putting all of his free time into the organization. This was on top of 12 and 14 hour days that he worked at the KFCs. And Gacy would offer free chicken to the other members of the organization while they were at meetings, and he was eventually given the nickname of Colonel, something that Gacy took to heart. There's a number of photographs of him floating around online of Gacy wearing a Colonel's uniform, which gives some idea of how important it was to him of what other people thought of him. The other members of the JCs would later say that he was something of a braggart and a ambitious individual, but they did hold him in high regard, and they named him outstanding vice president of the organization in 1967. Again, though, there was a darker side to Gacy's life. It was known that he was involved in wife swapping with other members of the JCs, and he would routinely hire prostitutes for other members when he would have them over to his house at the what he called the club, or even on JC's property where he would hold stag party nights, which is basically he would show pornographic films to other people. And on a number of occasions, he would show these films to just one person, usually a young male, after which Gacy would proposition them. And there's some stories out there stating that, you know, this may or may not have actually happened, but there is proof that Gacy actually did these things. In 1967, he sexually assaulted a 15-year-old by the name of Donald Voorhees, who was the son of a fellow JC. Gacy had convinced Voorhees to come over to the house to watch a pornographic film with him. And while there, Gacy plied the youth with alcohol before persuading him to engage in mutual oral sex. And Gacy is quoted as saying to the young boy that you have to have sex with a man before you start having sex with a woman. And his depraved acts only escalated from here. He would, as I stated earlier, abuse other children who came over to watch these films with them, one of which he supposedly convinced to have sex with his wife before he blackmailed the young man into performing oral sex on him. One trick that Gacy is supposed to have used during this period of time was to convince the other young men that he had been in fact commissioned to conduct homosexual experiments in the interest of scientific research, and Gacy would pay them $50 for each act they performed with him. Now, about 7 months after Gacy assaulted Donald Voorhees, the young man went to his father to let him know what Gacy had done to him. And the police were immediately informed of this, and Gacy was charged with performing oral sodomy on Voorhees and the attempted assault of a 16-year-old boy named Edward Lynch. Gacy vehemently denied the allegations and even went so far as to voluntarily take a polygraph test. Now, this test showed that Gacy was nervous and possibly misleading in his answers to questions regarding the assaults. And Gacy went on to publicly denounce his accusers, claiming that the charges were politically motivated, as Voorhees' father had opposed Gacy's nomination for appointment as president of the Iowa JCs. And a number of his colleagues in the JCs came to Gacy's defense. And despite this, he was indicted on May 10th, 1968, on the sodomy charge. Gacy would not go down quietly, however. On August 30th of 1968, he persuaded one of his employees to physically assault Voorhees to try and discourage the boy from testifying. And he did this by promising to pay the young man, Russell Schroeder, $300. And Schroeder naturally agreed, and he lured Voorhees to an isolated county park, sprayed the young man with mace in the face before he proceeded to beat him. Voorhees was able to escape the assault and immediately went and informed police of what had happened, identifying Schroeder as his attacker. The police arrested Schroeder the following day, and although he initially denied having anything to do with it, the young man eventually confessed to assaulting Voorhees at the behest of Gacy. Police rearrested Gacy and gave him an additional charge of hiring Schroeder to assault and intimidate a witness. On September 12th of 1968, Gacy was ordered to undergo a psychiatric evaluation at the University of Iowa, and he was examined by two different doctors over a period of 17 days, and he was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. Now, for those of you who don't know what that term means, it's what they used to call a sociopath, or, you know, and now what they call a psychopath. The doctors stated that Gacy was unlikely to benefit from any therapy or medical treatment, and that his behavior pattern was likely to bring him in repeated conflict with society. They did conclude, however, that Gacy was competent to stand trial. Gacy was eventually convicted of all charges and sentenced to 10 years in prison. And upon hearing the conviction, his wife filed for divorce, which led Gacy to inform his wife that he no longer wanted to see their children and that, in fact, the three of them were dead so far as he was concerned. The divorce was finalized on September 18th of 1969. While incarcerated at the Anamosa State Penitentiary, Gacy was noted as being a model prisoner, and shortly after his arrival at the prison, he was named as the head cook. He also joined the local inmate chapter of the JCs and increased its membership from about 50 to well over 600 men. He was released after 18 months due to his good behavior, as well as his association with the JCs. One important thing that happened while Gacy was in prison is that his father died on Christmas Day of 1969 from cirrhosis of the liver, and supposedly, according to reports, when Gacy was informed of this, he collapsed to the floor sobbing. He also attempted to get supervised release to go to the funeral, but this was denied. Gacy was officially paroled on June 18, 1970, and his conditions stipulated that he needed to relocate to Chicago and live with his mother, and that he also had to observe a 10 p.m. curfew. Gacy was picked up from the prison by a fellow JC from Waterloo who had remained close to Gacy during his incarceration and in fact believed that Gacy was innocent of all charges, that he would quote-unquote never go back to jail, and he fully intended to reestablish himself in Waterloo following the completion of his probation. Back in Chicago, Gacy quickly got a job working as a short order cook, and things were quiet for a little while. That is until February 12th of 1971, when he was charged with attempting to sexually assault a teenage boy who claimed that Gacy had lured him into his car at Chicago's Greyhound bus terminal and driven to his home, where he attempted to force the boy into sex. The boy ended up not showing up for court, and the charges against Gacy were dropped. On June 22nd of 1971, he was arrested yet again, this time for aggravated sexual battery and reckless conduct. A young man had come forward to the police and claimed that Gacy had flashed a sheriff's badge at him before luring him into his car and forcing the young man to perform oral sex. These charges were also dropped after the young man attempted to blackmail Gacy, and Gacy informed the police of the blackmail attempt. It's interesting to note here that the Iowa Board of Parole did not learn of the arrests that Gacy had incurred, nor of the charges against him. Because it's pretty obvious that had they found out the things he was up to in Chicago, Gacy would have been returned to prison to serve out the remainder of his sentence. Instead, in October of 1971, Gacy completed his parole, and the following month, records of his convictions were sealed. And this is where John Wayne Gacy's story really takes off. After completing his parole, he asked his mother to help him purchase a house, and he ended up buying the property located at 8213 West Somerdale Avenue in the village of Norridge in Norwood Park Township, which is in Cook County. So basically, still within the metropolitan Chicago area. Gacy's neighbors noted that he was very active in the local community, often helping them with various construction projects, as well as his willingness to loan construction tools to his neighbors. He was also known to plow everyone on the street's driveway free of charge. And it's another interesting thing here, because Gacy, you know, we know of his past. He still had that salesman's ability, and he used this to his advantage as he began to integrate himself into the community with both police officers and politicians. Gacy was noted for hosting parties during the summer in which people from all walks of life attended. Gacy was a very charismatic individual, which you imagine he would be as he was a salesman by profession. And, you know, he was able to slip in and out of these relationships with people, building something of an insulatory net around himself. While living at the house on West Summerdale, Gacy established his own business, PDM Contractors, which stood for painting, decorating, and maintenance. And he would work evenings at this construction job while doing the short order cook during the day. And this is important because Gacy would use this company as the means by which he would procure most of his victims. But at the time, everyone just assumed that, you know, he's a very ambitious man. He wants to do better for himself as well as for his mother. So they didn't really think anything of it. In 1972, July 1st to be exact, Gacy married for the second time. This time to Carol Hoff, who was a divorcee who had two young daughters. And by all accounts, Gacy's second marriage was much different than the first. Apparently, it was fairly strained from an early point. And by 1975, the marriage was nearly dead, as Gacy had sex with his wife on Mother's Day before informing her that was the last time they would have sex, after which he told her that he was a bisexual. During this period, Gacy began spending most of his nights away from the home, only to return the following morning with excuses such as he had been working late or that, you know, political commitments had kept him away. His wife began noticing that Gacy would bring young boys over to the house where they would hang out in the garage, and she eventually found gay pornography inside of the home, as well as men's wallets with identification inside. When she confronted Gacy about who these items belonged to, Gacy told her that it was none of her business. Now, we know that Gacy had something of an explosive temper, so I can only imagine that these confrontations led to Gacy going into obscenity-laden rants against his wife. Eventually, the family ended up splintering, and in October of 1975, Carol divorced her husband, and she ended up living in the house until February of 1976 when she and her daughters moved into their own apartment. And the reason that they ended up getting divorced, at least officially in court documents, is that Gacy was unfaithful to his wife with other women, but as we later learned, that was not the case. It had everything to do with Gacy's homosexual activities. Also during this period of time is when Gacy began performing as a clown. He was a member of a local moose club and ended up joining a organization known as Jolly Joker Clown Club, and these clowns would perform at charity and fundraising events as well as parades. They also would go into children's hospital to entertain the children. In 1975, Gacy created his own clown personas, one of which was Pogo the Clown, while the other was Patches. And Gacy described Pogo as happy, whereas Patches was a more serious clown. Now, Pogo is the more infamous of the two, and it was because of this clown that Gacy ended up earning the moniker for which he would be known, which is as the Killer Clown. One really disturbing thing I found while reading about him is that Gacy would often remain in his clown makeup after performing at a children's hospital or at a fundraiser, and he would go to a bar and drink before returning home, and I can only imagine what patrons in these establishments must have thought when they walked in to find a clown sitting at the bar getting drunk. Now, turning back to Gacy's company, PDM, obviously most of the people who worked for him were males. Gacy targeted specifically high school students and young men. And oftentimes, he would proposition them for sex or insist that they give him sexual favors in return for things like lending them vehicles, promotions, or even, you know, lending them a couple extra bucks. Gacy also told one employee, "Do you know how easy it would be to get one of my guns and kill you, and how easy it would be to get rid of the body?" During the early to mid-70s, Gacy is known to have really begun picking up on his homosexual acts. I've seen a couple things that have stated Gacy was a pedophile. I personally don't believe that to be true, as the majority of his victims were in mid-teens, 15, 16 years old, up until their 20s. In 1973, he's known to have traveled to Florida with one of his teenage employees to view a property that Gacy had purchased. And keep in mind that Gacy was still married at this point. Their first night in Florida, Gacy raped the young man in their hotel room. I could find nothing else that stated if he did anything else to the boy during this trip, but upon returning to Chicago, Gacy reportedly beat the young man in his front yard, and when questioned about it by his wife, Gacy claimed that the beating was because he had refused to pay the young man because he did shoddy work, and that the boy had attacked him as a result of this. His next known attack came in May of 1975, and this one is somewhat famous in Gacy lore, as it was a 15-year-old boy named Anthony Antonucci, who was also a fairly accomplished wrestler in high school. Gacy had gone to Anthony's home with him, where the two proceeded to drink and watch a porn film together, after which Gacy attacked the young man, eventually pinning him to the floor and putting handcuffs on his back. Unbeknownst to Gacy, however, the young man wasn't fully handcuffed. In fact, one of his hands was able to get free of the handcuffs. Gacy left the room for something, and when he returned, Anthony attacked him, wrestling Gacy to the floor and getting the handcuff key away from him, after which Antonucci handcuffed Gacy's own hands behind his back. Supposedly, Gacy threatened Anthony before calming down and promising to leave if he would remove the handcuffs. Antonucci eventually agreed and Gacy left. Antonucci later recalled that Gacy told him, "Not only are you the only one who got out of the cuffs, you got them on me." On July 26, 1976, Gacy picked up 18-year-old David Cram. Cram was hitchhiking on Elston Avenue. One thing about Gacy is he spent a lot of time during the evenings after work cruising the gay areas in and around Chicago looking for young men to entice into his car. And Cram was one of these. He offered him a job with PDM, and Cram began working that night. On August 21st, Cram moved into the house, and the following day, Cram and Gacy had a few drinks to celebrate the young man's birthday. One disturbing part of this particular story is that Gacy was dressed as Pogo the Clown while they were drinking and carrying on. Gacy was able to get Cram to don the handcuffs. This night, however, Gacy handcuffed Cram in front of his body before swinging Cram around the room while holding on to the chain link that connected the two cuffs. After informing Cram that he intended to rape the young man, Cram kicked Gacy in the face and was able to free himself from the handcuffs. Not long after this, Gacy appeared in the bedroom door to Cram's room, telling Cram, quote unquote, "Dave, you really don't know who I am. Maybe it would be good if you give me what I want." A fight broke out between the two of them, and Cram ended up straddling Gacy, who quickly left, telling Cram that he was no fun. Cram ended up moving out on October 5th of that year, and he quit the company the same day. Although, unfortunately for Cram, he did end up doing work for Gacy over the following years. Not long after David Cram left the house, another employee by the name of Michael Rossi moved in. And Rossi was something of a longtime employee for Gacy. And he would end up living with Gacy until April of 1977. And it seems almost like Rossi became Gacy's right-hand man, as there are reports that Rossi would go out and perform clowning gigs with Gacy at various parades and other functions, with Gacy performing as Pogo and Rossi as Patches. Gacy's first known murder took place in 1972, January 3rd to be exact. According to Gacy, he had been at a family party on the evening of January 2nd and decided to drive the Civic Center loop afterwards. And while driving, he ended up coming across a young boy by the name of Timothy Jack McCoy outside Chicago's Greyhound bus terminal. Now, Gacy took McCoy on a sightseeing tour of Chicago before driving back to the house with the promise that he would spend the night and the next day Gacy would drive him back to the Greyhound bus terminal so that he could catch his bus. Now, reports differ as to what happened next. The ones that I tend to believe is that Gacy raped this young man, although some say they had consensual sex, while others still say that nothing untoward happened between the two of them. However, according to Gacy's account, he woke the next morning to find McCoy standing in the door to the bedroom with a kitchen knife in his hand. Seeing this, Gacy jumped up and ended up grabbing McCoy, who had lifted the arm holding the knife up almost in like a defensive position, and this caused Gacy to get a cut on his arm. Gacy, because of this, according to his own words, was able to get the knife away from McCoy before smashing the young man's head against the bedroom wall. McCoy collapsed, and Gacy began kicking him to death. After a few more moments, Gacy ended up stabbing McCoy repeatedly in the chest, after which he walked out into the kitchen, and upon coming into the kitchen, he saw an open carton of eggs and some unsliced bacon on the kitchen table. McCoy apparently had set the table for the two of them and had been walking into the room to inform him that he was making breakfast for them both. McCoy is the first victim known to have been put into the crawl space. He was in fact covered by a layer of concrete. Gacy later said that he felt drained after the killing of the young man, but that he had experienced an orgasm during the murder, listing the gurgulations and gasping for air that came from his body as helping him reach climax. Gacy stated that after killing McCoy, he realized that death was the ultimate thrill. Now, his second victim, known victim that is, took place around 1974, and unfortunately, this young man remains unidentified. Gacy said that he stored the body inside his closet prior to burial, and that bodily fluids had leaked from the young man's mouth and nose, leading Gacy to eventually begin putting rags inside the victim's mouth after death so that they would not stain his carpet and thus leave evidence. This young man was eventually buried inside of the crawl space. His next known victim was John Butkovich. Now, Butkovich was one of Gacy's employees. He was 18 years old at the time that he disappeared. On July 31st of 1975, Butkovich's car was found parked near the corner of Sheridan and Lawrence, and Butkovich's jacket and wallet were inside of the vehicle as well as the keys. The day prior to his disappearance, which would be July 30th, Butkovich had gone to Gacy's house to confront him over 2 weeks' outstanding back pay. When Butkovich's car was found, his father called Gacy to ask about the whereabouts of his son. Gacy claimed that the two of them had reached a compromise and Gacy had in fact paid the young man, after which he had left. Gacy went on to further state that he would help the family look for the youth if they wanted to. Butkovich's father and mother were not content to let this particular one lie, however. Over the next 3 years, they reportedly contacted police well over 100 times in relation to the disappearance of their son, and they also insisted that the police investigate John Wayne Gacy, something the police did not do. Gacy stated that he encountered Butkovich exiting his car on West Lawrence Avenue and was able to get the youth into his car after Butkovich claimed that he needed to talk with Gacy. They drove to Gacy's house and Gacy gave Butkovich a drink before getting him into the handcuffs, which, again, some people are like, how could he do that? You know, you're angry at the boss. Gacy was really, really charismatic. As you heard in a few of the interviews I played during the trailer, he was a natural salesman. It wouldn't have been difficult for him to convince a young man to get into a pair of handcuffs during their rapport, just given Gacy's gregarious nature. So he got him into the handcuffs. And according to Gacy, after he got him into the handcuffs, he sat on the kid's chest for a while before strangling him. Now, Gacy put the body inside of the garage, intending to bury it in the crawl space. However, as Gacy was still married at this time, his wife and stepdaughters returned home earlier than Gacy had expected, and he ended up burying Butkovich underneath the subfloor in the garage. 1976 is the year that Gacy's murders really began to escalate, however. As I stated earlier, Gacy had begun cruising the gay bars and gay areas in and around Chicago. Not long after his divorce was finalized in 1976, he murdered an 18-year-old named Daniel Simpson, who was last seen on April 6th of 1976. 5 weeks later, on the afternoon of May 14th, a 15-year-old by the name of Randall Reffitt disappeared while walking home from high school. Not long after that, the same day, May 14th, a 14-year-old named Samuel Stapleton vanished as he walked home from his sister's apartment. The two of them were buried together in the crawl space. And you gotta think, envision this. These teens come into Gacy's house, and pretty much all of his murders were conducted in the same way. They would go into his den, where they would hang out, and Gacy would entertain them and regale them with various stories. And at some point, Gacy would show them a magic trick wherein he would put handcuffs on behind his back, only to magically reproduce his hands a few moments later, with the handcuffs in one hand. After which he would tell the boys, you know, I'll show you how to do the trick. Let me handcuff you. The boys would do it. And once in the handcuffs, Gacy would say something along the lines of, "The trick is to have the key, you little shit." After which Gacy would sexually assault the young man before either manually strangling them or doing something that he called the rope trick, which was a section of rope with a number of different knots inside of it. Gacy would put the rope around the young man's neck and then insert something such as a screwdriver in between the knots on the rope, which he would twist and turn until the victim strangled to death. On June 3rd, he killed a 17-year-old by the name of Michael Bonin, who was traveling from Chicago to Waukegan. A little over a week later, Gacy killed again, this time a young man by the name of William Carroll. On August 5th, he killed another young man by the name of James Hackinson. This victim phoned his family before his murder, and it's suspected that this phone call originated from Gacy's home. When investigators found Hackinson's body, it was buried beneath a 17-year-old by the name of Rick Johnson, who was last seen alive on August 6th. So it seems as though Gacy was killing one victim, holding his body in the house, then going out the next day, getting another victim, killing him, and then burying him together. And Gacy is kind of an anomaly in this regard. He has a lot of murders over a short couple years span. The only one that I can think of off the top of my head who operated in a similar fashion that we know of would be Gary Ridgway, where, you know, there would be, you know, multiple murders within a span of, you know, a day or two, or even, you know, three or four within a month period. And then he would go into his cooling off period that would last very shortly before he was out on the prowl again. It's suspected that he killed two more youths between August and October of 1976. However, it is known that he killed two boys, Kenneth Parker and Michael Marino, on October 24th. These two young men were last seen outside of a restaurant in Chicago. 2 days after that, another boy by the name of William Bundy disappeared after letting his family know he intended to go to a party. Bundy was another of the employees that Gacy killed. It doesn't appear that there were any murders for a short period of time after this, until December of 1976, when 17-year-old Gregory Godzik vanished. Now, Godzik is known to have told his family that Gacy had had him dig trenches for some kind of a drain tile beneath his house in the crawl space. Basically, what Gacy was having a lot of these boys do was dig their own graves without even realizing they were doing it. The reason for this is that Gacy would tell the boys that the crawl space had a history of flooding and that they were digging these trenches in order that he could put a sump pump down there and get the water out more easily. January 20th of 1977, Gacy killed again, this time a 19-year-old named John Zick. Now, if I'm not mistaken, Gacy had employed this young man as well. And at the time of this killing, Rossi was asleep in the house. Gacy later sold Sick's car to Rossi for $300. Now, the next few months to year is really up in the air They suspect Gacy killed one or two more people, but if we follow the pattern that Gacy had already established, it's much more likely that he killed more youths whose bodies were never found. And that is one of those things in this case. It's actually kind of a bone of contention because one of the detectives who originally worked the case has stated, and I believe he actually wrote a book ad on it, that Gacy had other dumping grounds, one of which was the apartment complex that his mother worked in, where Gacy was also the maintenance man. Supposedly, this man had been told by people who worked there that Gacy was routinely seen there either very early in the morning or really late at night digging holes out on the property. And we're going to get into this a little bit more at the end of the episode, but I do think it's really important to just bring that up at this point, that Gacy was committing murders, or at least I believe he was. You know, I tend to agree with this detective, that were never attributed to him, in which, you know, bodies have never been found. It's really odd that he would have this huge spate of killings over such a short period of time and then seemingly stop. Or not stop, but slow down to such an extent that there was only, you know, one or two in this time frame. It just doesn't jibe with his already established pattern of, you know, numerous killings over short periods of time with maybe a couple weeks cooling off period before he goes right back into killing. Something else that is rather interesting, at least to me, is that Gacy went on the record stating that he had been inspired in his own MOs as far as his killings by the Houston mass murderer Dean Corll. You know, Gacy had read of Corll. Remember, Corll took place, I believe it was 1973 or something like that he died. I'm probably wrong on that date. But you can go back in the archives and find the episode. Anyways, Gacy did state that he was inspired by the murders that Corll had committed. He also stated, at least in one interview, that he had been procuring boys for an underground sex club that traded in young men. And there is some evidence that Gacy may have peripherally been involved with the pedophile ring that was operating out of North Fox Island in Michigan. I'm going to dive into this really quick because I'm on a roll. North Fox Island was one of two small islands. This one particularly had an airstrip on it and was owned by a millionaire by the name of Francis Sheldon. And Sheldon had opened up a camp on North Fox Island for disadvantaged youth. And eventually it came out that Sheldon was sexually abusing the boys that came to this camp, and that he was trafficking these boys out of state to other parts of the country because he was running ads in the back of various underground gay magazines specifically targeting pedophiles. Sheldon was found to have index cards with many of the boys known to Dean Corll on them, and vice versa. A lot of the index cards that Corll had contained the names of boys unknown to the police in that area who had disappeared from other parts of the country, which gave credence to the accusation from Elmer Wayne Henley and David Brooks that Corll had initially told them that he was selling boys into a nationwide pedophile ring. The reason I bring all of this up is they found information at Gacy's home as well as in Sheldon's possession, that Sheldon and Gacy had been in contact, and that Gacy may have been supplying young boys to Sheldon, as well as that Sheldon may have been supplying Gacy with young boys. Again, this is speculation, as this information, while it is known to be out there, has never been officially released to the public. Back to the killings. Gacy is known to have continued with his murderous ways. He actually, from what they know, picked up his murders once again in 1977, killing a number of boys, many of which who were buried underneath his house in the crawl space. December 30th of 1977, Gacy took a young boy by the name of Robert Donnelly from a Chicago bus stop at gunpoint, where he drove him home, raped, tortured, and repeatedly dunked his head into a bathtub until he passed out. Gacy taunted this young man with statements such as, "Aren't we playing fun games tonight?" This one is an odd one, as Donnelly eventually asked Gacy if he was just going to kill him already, to which Gacy replied, "I'm getting around to it." Gacy released Donnelly, driving him to his workplace and letting Donnelly know that if he went to police with accusations of what Gacy had done to him, the police would believe him and not Donnelly. Donnelly was not willing to let this lie, and he went to the police, who questioned Gacy on January 6th of 1978. Gacy admitted to having had a sex-slave relationship with Donnelly. He insisted everything was consensual, stating that he did not pay the kid any of the money that he had promised to him, which is the reason why Donnelly had gone to the police. As Gacy had told him, the police believed John Wayne Gacy. Shortly after this brief run-in with the law, Gacy began his killing spree anew. He murdered a young man by the name of William Kindred, who disappeared on February 16th, that he was spending the evening in a bar. Kindred is the last victim that was buried in the crawl space. On March 21st, a 26-year-old by the name of Jeffrey Ringel was lured into Gacy's car. Gacy rendered him unconscious using chloroform, after which he sexually assaulted him and dumped his body in a park. It's at this point Gacy's psychosis is really starting to spiral out of control. You know, he's had so many victims that, you know, he hasn't gotten busted for, as well as a number of victims who survived and went to the police and nothing happened to, that Gacy has, at this point, begun to see himself as, you know, pretty much invincible. Ringel eventually was able to get the police involved, and Gacy was arrested for the assault. Gacy was not done killing, however, even though the crawl space was full. Again, I believe there were bodies buried elsewhere, but he told police that he had considered putting bodies into the attic once the crawl space was filled, but that he had decided against this when he realized that leakage from the bodies might cause complications in other areas of the house. Instead, Gacy began throwing bodies of his victims off the I-55 bridge into the Des Plaines River. Gacy stated that he threw at least 5 bodies into the Des Plaines River. However, only 4 of them were ever found. Now, the next murder that Gacy committed is the one that finally brought him down, and that's the murder of Robert Priest. On the afternoon of December 11th, 1978, Gacy went to Nissen Pharmacy in Des Plaines to discuss possibly remodeling the store. And while he was there, apparently Peast overheard Gacy talking with the store's owner, mentioning that he was possibly looking to hire more employees. Also going on to state that he routinely hired young teenage boys as they were hardworking and dependable, and that he paid these employees $5 an hour, which in 1978 was a lot of money. Gacy left the pharmacy, and Robert Peast's mother arrived to pick him up with the intention of bringing her son home so that they could celebrate her birthday together. Gacy ended up coming back to the store, claiming that he had forgotten something, and it was at this point that he and Peast ended up making contact. And here's where Gacy slipped up. Peast had told his mother that he needed to talk to a contractor about getting some extra work, after which he left the store to speak with Gacy, telling his mother they were just going outside and that he would be back in shortly. That's not what happened. Gacy drove Peast to his home, and it's speculated that he murdered the young man around 10 p.m. Gacy stated later he asked Peast whether there was anything he wouldn't do for the right price, to which Peast replied that he did not mind working hard. Gacy was eventually able to convince Peast to try on the rope on the handcuffs, after which he placed the rope around Peast's neck, and according to Gacy, the boy was crying scared. Gacy then abused the boy before murdering him. Peast's family immediately contacted the police when their son did not come back into the store, and after talking with the owner of the store, police began looking into John Wayne Gacy. One of the officers talked with Peast's mother and decided that there was no way that Robert Peast had run away from home. So this officer named Joseph Konzenkak looked into Gacy's background and saw the outstanding battery charge against him. A couple of different places state that Konzenkak saw that Gacy had been in prison for sodomy on a 15-year-old boy. I find this hard to believe, as we know for a fact that Gacy's record was sealed after he completed his probation. At any rate, the next evening, Kozensak and two Plain police officers went to Gacy's home. Gacy said that he had spoken to two boys that were working at the place, and that he had asked one of them, who he believed to be Peast, whether there were any remodeling materials behind the store. He was adamant, however, that he never once offered Robert Peast a job, and had only gone back to the store as he had left his appointment book there. After assuring the officers that he would go back to police station later that evening to make a formal statement, the officers asked why he couldn't do it then. Gacy told them that his uncle had just died, to which the police pushed him on the issue, asking how soon he would be there. Gacy supposedly replied that they were very rude and asked them if they did not have any respect for the dead. Gacy's whereabouts are unknown after that point until 3:20 a.m. that morning. I've seen a bunch of different things on this about what Gacy was doing during that time. The consensus seems to be that after the police visited his house, Gacy had kind of hung out for a little while, waiting till the heat was off before getting rid of Robert Peast's body and tidying up his home in an attempt to destroy any evidence. Upon arriving at the police station, it was noted that Gacy was covered in mud, and he claimed this was because he was involved in a car accident. He left, only returned later that day, at which point he denied any involvement in Peast's disappearance, reaffirming his statement that he had never offered the young boy a job with him. When pressed further as to why he had returned to the pharmacy, Gacy stated that the store's owner had called him to inform him that he had left his appointment book at the pharmacy. Police instantly knew this was a lie. They had already spoken to the pharmacy's owner, who stated that he had never called Gacy. Gacy ended up preparing a written statement for the police. On December 13th, police were able to get a search warrant for John Wayne Gacy's home, as they believed that he was possibly holding him against his will. They did not find Peast or anything linked to him, but they did find a number of suspicious items in the house, including a number of police badges, a 6mm starter pistol, as well as a syringe and hypodermic needle inside a cabinet in Gacy's bedroom. They also found handcuffs, books on homosexuality, and pedophilia, a few pornographic films, capsules of amyl nitrate, which is a sex drug, as well as an 18-inch dildo. They also found a 39-inch 2x4 with two holes drilled into each end, bottles of Valium, as well as a number of IDs belonging to other people, and various items of clothing that were obviously not Gacy's. In one of the bedrooms, the police found a class ring from 1975. It was engraved with the initials JAS. Also in this room was a receipt from the pharmacy and a 36-inch section of rope. They ended up confiscating Gacy's car as well as all of the PDM vehicles. After this, the police began surveilling Gacy. And this went on for quite a little while. Gacy would come to have an antagonistic relationship with the officers who were surveilling him. He would buy them dinner, while at other times he would come and out and cuss them out, asking them if they didn't have anything better to do with their time. And it's been said in a number of different areas that Gacy treated a lot of these officers who were following him around almost as though they were his friends. Now, the day after the surveillance began, police got their first real bit of information on John Gacy. They were contacted by Michael Rossi, who let the investigators know that one of his former co-workers, Gregory Godzik, had disappeared, and that another one of his co-workers, Charles Hatula, had been found drowned in the Illinois River earlier that year. December 15th, the police received more information on the battery charged against Gacy. If you remember, that was the one that involved Jeffrey Rignall, who had been picked up, drugged, assaulted, and then dropped in a park. One of the bits of information that police were able to get from this report was that Rignold had chest and facial burns, as well as severe rectal bleeding. That same day, they learned of another disappearance. That's of John Butkovich, as well as the owner of the high school ring that they had found, which was John Allen Zick. Zick's mother revealed that several items from his apartment were missing, including a Motorola TV set. This is important because that Motorola TV set was later found inside of Casey's home. Police began interviewing various employees of John Wayne Gacy, one of whom stated that Gacy had a hard-working lifestyle but had an open mind when it came to sex between men. He also stated that Gacy had given him a watch at one point because he was always late, and when asked where the watch had come from, Gacy stated he got it from a dead man. Gacy continued taunting police again during all of this, at one point informing one of the investigators that, you know, clowns can get away with murder. The police also continued interviewing his employees, and it's through this that they learned about one of them being sold Sick's vehicle, and that he explained that he had bought the vehicle from Sick because he needed the money to move to California. The police, while learning about the sale of the car, also learned that there was evidence that Robert Peast had, in fact, been inside Gacy's Oldsmobile, and they did this using German Shepherds, or what's called cadaver dogs. The dogs gave what's called a death reaction. They also found fibers in the trunk of the car, which investigators believed may have been human hair. On December 18th, Gacy went to his lawyer's office to complain about the constant surveillance and to bring a civil suit against the Des Plaines police, demanding that they stop their surveillance. That same day, and this is where a really big break came, the Nissen Pharmacy receipt that had been found at Gacy's house. It was actually for a receipt for photographs. For younger listeners, you used to have to take your cameras or your film into a pharmacy or a camera store in order to get it developed. And when you did it, you would put it inside an envelope that had a number written on it, and there was a perforated piece of paper on that envelope that also had that numbers. So you would pull that piece off and they would send it out to be developed, and when you came to pick your film up, you would present them with that slip of paper so that they would know which photographs were yours. Well, this particular piece of paper happened to correspond with photos belonging to one of Robert Peast's co-workers. And the reason that Robert Peast had possession of that piece of paper was that he had let the young woman borrow his jacket, and she had, without thinking, placed the receipt into the pocket of that jacket. That same evening, December 18th, police again interviewed Rossi, who informed them that he had spread a decent amount of lime underneath Gacy's house in the crawl space. The next day, police began to put in for a second search warrant. As they were preparing the search warrant, Gacy's lawyer filed a civil suit against the police, and the hearing was scheduled to be heard on December 22nd. However, that afternoon, the 19th, Gacy had the surveillance detectives come inside of his house so he could talk with them. And this shows, you know, the ego on John Wayne Gacy. He still has this idea in his head that he's invincible. while he is talking with one of the investigators, the other went into Gacy's bedroom, where he attempted to write down the number of the small Motorola TV that he found inside of it. Remember, John 6 Motorola TV had gone missing, and this would later be proven to be John's television. The officer then went and used Gacy's bathroom, and when he flushed the toilet, he noticed what he later said was a smell that he suspected to be that of rotting corpses, and this was coming from the heating duct. The officers then left, and the next day they interviewed Cram and Rossi again. They learned from Rossi that Gacy had attempted to rape him in 1976, and that Gacy had turned white when they returned to his home after seeing mud on the carpet. He said Gacy then went down into the crawl space with a flashlight to look for quote-unquote evidence of digging. Officers asked Cram whether or not he had been in the crawl space, and Cram said that he had been there one point to dig trenches and spread lime for Gacy. Rossi also admitted to digging trenches for Gacy in the crawl space, and he also said that Gacy was very specific about where these trenches needed to be dug and that he would not tolerate any deviation from this. The next day, December 20th, John Wayne Gacy confessed to his lawyer. He went to his lawyer's office to discuss the pending civil suit he had against the police department. According to his lawyer, Gacy was disheveled, looking, and shaken, and asked for a glass of whiskey. And when his lawyer brought it back, he asked Gacy, you know, what's going on, to which Gacy replied by picking up a copy of the local newspaper and pointing to the front page article that covered the disappearance of Robert Priest. "This boy is dead. He's in a river," is what Gacy is quoted as saying. After which, he went on a rambling confession, telling his lawyer everything, and this confession went on so long that it was the early morning hours of December 21st that he actually finished. Gacy is quoted as saying that he had been judge, jury, and executioner to many, many people, and that he wanted to do the same thing to himself. He's quoted as saying that his victims had been male prostitutes, hustlers, and liars to whom he gave the rope trick, further claiming that often he would awaken to find dead, strangled kids on his floor with their hands cuffed behind their backs, and that he had buried these bodies in the crawl space as he believed that they were his property. Now, at some point during his confession, Gacy passed out from the amount of alcohol that he had been ingesting, and his lawyer, Sam Amarante, scheduled a psychiatric competency for him the following day at 9 a.m. When informed of this the next day and asked about his confession, Gacy is quoted as saying, "Well, I can't think about this right now. I think I've got things to do," after which he left his lawyer's office. It was apparent now that Gacy was realizing the noose was around his neck. He later described the next few days as hazy. He's known to have told a gas station attendant that the end is coming for me. These guys are going to kill me. After this statement was given, he drove to a home of a fellow contractor whom he hugged before bursting into tears and saying, "I've been a bad boy. I killed 30 people, give or take a few." Immediately following this, Gacy drove to Cram Cram's home, where he met up with Cram and Rossi. The surveillance officers stated that they observed Gacy holding a rosary to his chin, praying heavily while he drove. After speaking with both Cram and Rossi, Gacy had Cram drive him to a meeting with his lawyer. While Gacy was in this meeting, Cram informed the officers that Gacy had told him he had admitted to his lawyer the previous evening that he had killed over 30 people. Following this, Cram drove Gacy to the cemetery where his father was buried, and police kind of realized that Gacy was saying goodbye to all his old haunts and friends, just by the way he was behaving and the things he was doing. He was going to places, and it was almost like he was saying a final goodbye. While all this was going on, the police were formalizing and finalizing their second search warrant, specifically to look for the body of Robert Peast in the crawl space. After talking with the surveillance officers, they learned that Gacy may actually be suicidal. As the officers relayed the information that the clerk at the gas station had told them, as well as the fact that Gacy had given the young man a bag of pot. So, fearing that he might kill himself, the police decided to arrest Gacy on the charge of distributing marijuana. So, Gacy ended up being arrested on this charge, and while he was in custody, police told him that they were going to be searching the property looking for the body of Robert Peast. Gacy told them that they would not find the body buried there, but that he had killed another young boy in self-defense, and that they would find the body underneath his garage. When the police arrived at Gacy's home, the first thing they noticed was the smell inside the house. Upon going into the crawl space, they found that Gacy had intentionally unplugged his sump pump, which in turn led to the crawl space flooding with water. After getting the pump going again, the crawl space quickly drained of water, and they began to excavate the area, with one technician going down inside. He quickly found a putrefied arm bone coming from a human. After finding this, the technician called out to the others that they needed to charge Gacy with murder, following up with, "I think this place is full of kids." As the police continued their careful digging, they turned up more bones, a pair of legs, and another lower leg. The police quickly surmised that the bodies were too far decomposed to be pieced. However, that didn't matter. They had enough to arrest Gacy. They arrested him while he was already in custody and told him of what they had found. And Gacy told the officers he wanted to clear the air. That morning, December 22nd, John Wayne Gacy, in the presence of his lawyer, gave a formal statement during which he confessed to the murder of approximately 30 young men. He also claimed during this that each one of these men had willingly entered his home. He described in great grisly detail the murders he committed, often referring to the victims by name. And when pressed on the issue of Robert Peast, Gacy finally admitted that he had lured the young man to his home on the evening of December 11th, and he went on to state that he had disposed of the body in the DePlains River in the early hours of December 13th, which is right around the time that he went into the police station. After this, things happened fast. Gacy was taken to the bridge to show where he had disposed of Robert Peast's body. He was driven to his house to mark out where he had buried a body in the garage. And then he drew a diagram of the crawl space with an area marking off where he had buried bodies. And you can find footage of the excavation online, as the police had to have the house torn down. And you can see them just pulling up piece after piece of body, or a little bit of bone, from the sludgy soil. And I remember reading a book on this years ago, that there were instances where the police became violently ill after encountering bloodworms, which is worms that infest a decomposing body and feast on the flesh and fluids. And all of this was in this really rich, loamy, wet soil. So they're out there sifting through all of this painstakingly because they don't want to miss any piece of evidence. Robert Peast's body was discovered on April 9th, 1979. It was entangled in an exposed roots on the edge of the Des Plaines River in Grundy County. Dental records were needed to identify the body. And one of the things that they found was that three wads of paper-like material had been shoved down the young man's throat, and that it was this, in fact, that had killed him. I'm not going to get into the whole trial. Gacy was brought to trial in 1980 on the charge of 33 murders. In the end, John Wayne Gacy was found guilty of 33 charges of murder. He was also found guilty of sexual assault and taking indecent liberties with a child. The time of his conviction, it was the most amount of murders that a single person had ever been convicted for in the United States. After 2 hours of deliberation, John Wayne Gacy was sentenced to death. Naturally, Gacy appealed the death sentence a number of times, as well as giving conflicting stories as to what actually happened. As you heard in the opening of the show, he tried to claim that he didn't do it. He also claimed that he had accomplices, and that detective that I referred to earlier in the show, when I was discussing the possibility of the bodies being buried elsewhere, has said that there is evidence that John Wayne Gacy did in fact have accomplices, although to date none of these have ever been identified, or if they have, their identities have not been released to the public. While in prison, Gacy began painting, and you can find a lot of his stuff online. Gacy's paintings of clowns have kind of become some pretty sought-after murderabilia, with stars such as Johnny Depp and others owning pieces of it. Gacy's execution was carried out on May 10th, 1994. He was executed by lethal injection and pronounced dead at 12:58 a.m. His final words were, "Kiss my ass." There have been some developments in the intervening years since Gacy's execution, one of which is that a few detectives believe he was not acting alone, as they claim they have travel records for Gacy that show he was not in Chicago or the surrounding areas at the time of at least 16 murders. That is it for this week. I hope you have enjoyed the Deathcast. This is by far the longest episode I have ever done. I thought about splitting it up into two different parts, but I really don't think a case like John Wayne Gacy should be treated as such. He was such a disgusting, reprehensible human being in every regard that it's really... I just wanted to get him out and done with. I may revisit it at some point to discuss other aspects of the case. If I do, I will probably put them up on the Patreon page located at patreon.com/IanTottenAuthor. Until next week, be safe and stay morbid.
Welcome to the Deadcast.